Drive Time on RTE Radio 1 with National Irish Bank. The bank that brought Danske Bank's international expertise to Ireland is now bringing the Danske Bank name.
Now, this afternoon, Alan Shatter was supposed to have been meeting with the parents of an Air Corps cadet killed in a training crash 4 years ago. It's a case that has interesting echoes of the controversy that has detained the minister in the Dáil and prevented him from attending that meeting. Civilian and military investigations into the crash are at odds with each other, and the minister has repeatedly backed the Air Corps version of events to the distress of the family of cadet David Jevons. Philip Outyer-Hayes has been speaking to the family. What are they looking for, Philip?
Mary, David's parents, Donal and Liz, are distressed by what has now become the official military record. The civilian investigation by the Air Accident Investigation Unit into the crash effectively exonerates their son of any blame for the crash. That's backed up by the coroner's verdict, which records accidental death in David's case, but an open verdict in that of the plane instructor's death. But then the Defence Forces Court of Inquiry published findings which say that the decisions which led to the crash were made jointly by both men. Now, this is a conclusion which just doesn't tally with the known facts, but it is one that Alan Shatter has supported in supporting the Defence Forces as recently as just yesterday. To understand all the context for this, though, we need first to look back in more detail at what happened on the day of the crash, the 12th of October 2009.
At 4:20 in the afternoon, Irish Air Corps training flight Foxtrot 265 left Baldonnell with Cadet David Jevons piloting from the front, accompanied by instructor Captain Derek Furness. This was the first of three such flights that day, departing at 15-minute intervals, but the actions of the other two aircraft stand in marked contrast to those of Flight 265. There was clear flying and good weather as they tracked west over prosperous County Kildare, northwest to Carrigallen in Leitrim, and from there, the planned route was southwest over Loch Mask and the Partrie Mountains to Mam Cross. But at the eastern shore of Loch Mask, over Ballinrobe, the cadet identified bad weather ahead, a reducing cloud base that would have caused them to descend from 1,500 feet towards 1,000 feet. The cockpit voice recorder transcript shows how he advised diverting south around the bad weather and flying on directly to their destination in Galway. But the instructor overruled him.
I can see that I cannot climb over that high ground with the weather the way it is. I'm going to have to cut across the front, sir, and cancel my time check at Mam.
OK, hang on. Let's continue in and let's look at our options when we get in a bit further, all right?
Flying at 214 knots, Flight 265 would have been covering ground at about the rate of a mile every 15 seconds. It wasn't long before the high ground of the Partrie Mountains, partially shrouded in cloud, were upon them. Cadet Jevons indicates again that the weather is unsuitable, or as he says, US, and suggests a point to do a 180-degree turn. But Captain Furness also points out two valleys that they can fly up.
OK, sir, if I continue on now, and it is US, I have the hill in our 11 o'clock. I could come around the back of that.
Exactly.
Where there's low ground.
OK, we've also got two valleys that we can fly up. We've got that one in our 12 to 1 o'clock, OK?
Seen, sir.
The Air Accident Investigation Unit report suggests a number of things that were going on at this point. The instructor was highly regarded and experienced, and it is probable that this influenced his decision to press on into deteriorating weather and rising terrain. Of the cadet, they observed that from this point on, tactical decision-making had passed to the instructor, even though he was still flying the plane. Thus, the cadet had little further input into decisions and was evidently unsure as to what further decisions on the direction of the flight he was expected to make. The instructor then gave the order to deviate from the planned route and fly into the mountains up the Finney Valley.
Let's go right.
OK, sir.
The weather was deteriorating, the cloud dropping, and Flight 265 had to drop to the minimum authorised level for flights of this kind, 1,000 feet.
1,200, sir.
Say again?
1,200, sir.
I'd suggest down to 1,000 feet if we can get it.
OK, sir.
As they flew up the Finnie Valley, normal cockpit procedure broke down as the instructor took control of the plane without advising the cadet. He turned the plane sharply left and south towards the hills on the north face of the Crumlin Valley. Handing back the controls to the cadet, he then instructed him to fly into the valley through a dip or a saddle in the hills.
OK, you've got the track. Do you see where we're going?
Yes, sir.
OK, you've control.
OK, sir. Just to the gap in the mountain ahead?
Yeah.
Seconds later, as they came up on the hills on the north face of the Crumlin Valley, the ground was rising quickly beneath them and the cadet indicated that he wanted to gain altitude.
Power on to get some altitude.
No. Hold it there.
OK, sir.
We want ground contact.
High ground on the right, not to affect.
The altitude alarm was automatically triggered as they breached the 1,000-foot flying limit for the mission. In fact, they crossed the saddle into the Crumlin Valley at 436 feet, more than 60 feet below the Irish Air Corps minimum height restriction. The Air Accident Investigation Unit suggests that it is probable that the pilot had lost situational awareness at this point and thought that what lay ahead was clear ground to their intended waypoint at Malm Cross. In fact, they were flying into a high-sided canyon-like valley with mountains to the north, south and west and a wall of dense low-lying cloud to the east. GPS data suggests as they crossed Crumlin Valley, they were flying at 1,400 feet with a 1,500-foot mountain directly ahead of them. As they realised their situation, the instructor took formal control for the last 40 seconds of the flight.
I've control.
You've control, sir.
The plane banked hard left, subjecting the two men to immense negative G-forces.
Bad decision now.
He banked hard left again to try and cross back over the valley in the direction he had come. There are no more exchanges between the two men on the cockpit voice recorder that have been published, but the data recorder indicates that the instructor pitched the plane up and climbed over 750 feet. He had gained sufficient altitude to clear the hills in front of him, but as he headed up into cloud, he became disoriented and subject to what pilots call an inversion illusion. Without the benefit of a horizon, he believed he had gone too far up and had turned the craft upside down. He compensated and pushed the nose of the plane down, dropping 900 feet into the side of the hill.
Both men would have been killed instantly. Meanwhile, the other two flights, Foxtrot 261 and 266, flying 15 and 30 minutes behind respectively, both made the same decision as Cadet David Jevons and turned left over Loch Mask and routed south to Galway, avoiding the bad weather.
So, Philip, how do the civilian and the military investigations differ?
In many respects, they're the same, but the civilian investigation, the Air Accident Investigation Unit report, highlights how the key decisions before the crash were made by the instructor and not by David Jevons. He was the one who pressed on into the weather, whereas you've just heard the other two instructors diverted directly to Galway. He didn't reduce speed. He was flying into rising terrain with low cloud base, and he directed the flight into the narrow confines of the Crumlin Valley, and it was absolutely not disputed that he was flying the plane for the last 40 seconds. But the military inquiry completely neglects to mention that Cadet Jevons suggested that they divert around the bad weather, but that it was Captain Furness who directed him to fly on into it, which is a pretty important omission. And it certainly set the context for what happened in the last 5 minutes of the flight before the crash. Its use of language as well suggests that the crew acted in unison throughout and that the crew made all of these decisions together, while the civilian investigation says that the instructor had in effect assumed tactical control of the flight before assuming actual control of the plane. And there's a number of other respects in which Donal Jevons, David's father, feels that his son's reputation has been damaged.
It shows that the instructor had instigated the avoidance option by flying into the weather, which is in total contradiction to the words that are recorded on the cockpit voice recorder.
Your concern now is that as a matter of military record, according to the Court of Inquiry's own report, your son shares responsibility for the decision to fly into bad weather, and that's something that you want to see rectified.
Yes, that's what we have a major concern with. In terms of the Court of Inquiry, the other investigations have completely exonerated David, the air accident report and the coroner's inquest. But in this internal Court of Inquiry, there is a shared responsibility put onto David for the cause of the crash, and we want to see that removed. And we are adamant that it is does not stay in that. That has a false reflection on David's military honour.
Because there is a stain on his reputation and his name, to your mind.
It's quite definite. What's in that Court of Inquiry is not correct, and we will not rest until that is removed.
And David's father, Donal, and his mother, Liz, they've also highlighted problems in how the Air Corps was run at the time. What are they saying?
Again, these are findings, quite trenchant criticisms, in fact, that were made by the civilian authority of the Air Corps, which just do not make it into the military inquiry at all. They say that there was ineffective command and control at the Air Corps flight training school. This is because at the time the officer commanding there was also a pilot on the government jet, and as such he was off base for 70 or 80% of the time. Now, one of the things, one of the key things here that is actually really relevant to what happened on the day of the crash was that nobody noticed that the audits for the flight training school, which were supposed to have been conducted every year, just were not being completed. There was none done between 2004 and 2009. And when they were done, they were inaccurate. Now, this is particularly relevant to the crash for one reason. There are, or there were at the time in the Air Corps, four approved ways for avoiding bad weather of the kind that Derek Furness and David Jevons flew into on that day. You either fly over it, you turn 180 degrees and fly away from it, or you do a series of dogleg turns and you fly around it, or you do, as Derek Furness tried to do on that day, you execute an emergency low-level abort, pitching steeply up into the cloud. But the problem here is that the audit said that training had been provided for emergency low-level aborts, but the facts established at the inquest were that the instructor wouldn't have been trained in a plane or in a simulator in how to execute a low-level abort. So, I'll put it this way, the logical thing to do when you do not have that training is that no flight training school planes should have been putting themselves into a situation where they would have had to rely upon an emergency low-level abort. Again, this leaves Donal Jevons feeling that had the flight training school been properly audited and run at the time, that things might have been very different.
In the air accident report, it's quite specific in that there was no training carried out in the flying training school for emergency low-level aborts, which was the last manoeuvre carried out by the instructor flying the aircraft that day. From what we gathered at the inquest, number one, that there was no training in reality for emergency low-level aborts. And we've also been informed also that there was no training for emergency low-level aborts from a simulator point of view. So they were never practiced in any manner whatsoever.
But the flight safety audits say what?
The flight safety audit said that all emergency in-flight procedures were practiced regularly in a realistic manner, which contradicts everything that was given in the air accident investigation report and the evidence that was given to us at the inquest.
So if the flight safety audits was a true and accurate reflection of the kind of training that was being conducted in Baldonnell, both your son and the instructor would have more regularly or at some stage practiced emergency low-level aborts.
That would have been absolutely correct. There was no doubt whatsoever that if I had been trained for the scenario might be a different situation today.
And as we said at the outset, Philip, the family was supposed to meet Alan Shatter today. He was detained in the Dáil on other business. Is there any indication how the family's meeting went with the department?
They must still be in the department because I haven't been able to speak to them. But it is interesting, and this is an indication of the way the meeting has probably gone. In response to a parliamentary question yesterday, the minister indicated that he didn't share any of the Jevons family's concerns and that he wasn't going to be reopening any investigation. He feels that there is no difference between these civilian and military reports, but as we've just showed here, a close enough reading of them shows they don't tally with each other. All of which is all the more poignant for the Jevons family, as in the week that their son David died, their second son decided that he wanted to follow his older brother into the Air Corps, and he has just started this year in the flight training school.
Philip Boucher-Hayes, thank you very much.